last end of the war, I hope," said Merry.
"I hope so," said Frodo, and sighed. "The very last stroke. But to think that it should fall here, at the very door of Bag End. Among all my hopes and fears, at least I never expected that."
"I shan't call it the end till we've cleared up the mess," said Sam gloomily, "and that'll take a lot of time and work."
Chapter 9. The Grey Havens. The clearing up certainly needed a lot of work, but it took less time than Sam had feared. The day after the battle, Frodo rode to Mickle Delving and released the prisoners from the lockholes. One of the first that they found was poor Fredegar Bulger, fatty no longer. He'd been taken when the ruffians smoked out a band of rebels that he led from their hidings up in the Brockenbors by the hills of Skerry.
"You'd have done better to come with us after all, poor old Fredegar," said Pippin, as they carried him out, too weak to walk. He opened an eye and tried gallantly to smile.
"Who's this young giant with a loud voice?" he whispered. "Not little Pippin. What's your size in hats now?"
Then there was Lobelia. Poor thing, she looked very old and thin when they rescued her from a dark and narrow cell. She insisted on hobbling out on her own feet, and she had such a welcome, and there was such clapping and cheering when she appeared, leaning on Frodo's arm but still clutching her umbrella, that she was quite touched, and drove away in tears. She'd never in her life been popular before, but she was crushed by the news of Lotho's murder, and she would not return to Bag End. She gave it back to Frodo, and went to her own people, the Brace Girdles of Hardbottle. When the poor creature died next spring, she was after all more than 100 years old, Frodo was surprised and much moved. She had left all that remained of her money and of Lotho's for him to use in helping hobbits made homeless by the Troubles. So that feud was ended. Old Will Whitfoot had been in the lockholds longer than any, and though he'd perhaps been treated less harshly than some, he needed a lot of feeding up before he could look the part of mayor. So Frodo agreed to act as his deputy, until Mr. Whitfoot was in shape again. The only thing that he did as deputy mayor was to reduce the sheriffs to their proper functions and numbers. The task of hunting out the last remnant of the ruffians was left to Merry and Pippin, and it was soon done. The southern gangs, after hearing the news of the Battle of Bywater, fled out of the land and offered little resistance to the Thane. Before the year's end, the few survivors were rounded up in the woods, and those that surrendered were shown to the borders. Meanwhile, the labour of repair went on apace, and Sam was kept very busy. Hobbits can work like bees when the mood and the need comes on them. Now there were thousands of willing hands of all ages, from the small but nimble ones of the hobbit lads and lasses to the well-worn and horny ones of the gaffers and gammers. Before Yule, not a brick was left standing of the new sheriff houses or of anything that had been built by Sharkey's men. But the bricks were used to repair many an old hole to make it snugger and drier. Great stores of goods and food and beer were found that had been hidden away by the ruffians in sheds and barns and deserted holes, and especially in the tunnels at Mickle Delving and in the old quarries at Skerry, so that there was a great deal better cheer that Yule than anyone had hoped for. One of the first things done in Hobbiton, before even the removal of the new mill, was the clearing of the hill and Bag End, and the restoration of Bagshot Row. The front of the new sandpit was all levelled and made into a large sheltered garden, and new holes were dug in the southward face, back into the hill, and they were lined with brick. The gaffer was restored to number 3, and he said often, and did not care who heard it,
"It's an ill wind as blows nobody no good, as I always say, and all's well as ends better."
There was some discussion of the name that the new row should be given. Battle Gardens was thought of, or Better Smiles. But after a while, in sensible hobbit fashion, it was just called New Row. It was a purely Bywater joke
to refer to it as Sharky's End.
The trees were the worst loss and damage, for at Sharky's bidding they'd been cut down recklessly far and wide over the Shire, and Sam grieved over this more than anything else. For one thing, this hurt would take long to heal, and only his great-grandchildren, he thought, would see the Shire as it ought to be. Then suddenly one day, for he had been too busy for weeks to give a thought to his adventures, he remembered the gift of Galadriel. He brought the box out and showed it to the other travellers, for so they were now called by everyone, and asked their advice.
"I wondered when you'd think of it," said Frodo. "Open it."
Inside it was filled with a grey dust, soft and fine, in the middle of which was a seed, like a small nut with a silver shale.
"What can I do with this?" said Sam.
"Throw it in the air on a breezy day and let it do its work," said Pippin.
"On what?"
said Sam.
"Choose one spot as a nursery and see what happens to the plants there," said Merry. "But I'm sure the lady would not like me to keep it all for my own garden, now so many folk have suffered," said Sam.
"Use all the wits and knowledge you have of your own, Sam," said Frodo, "and then use the gift to help your work and better it, and use it sparingly. There's not much here, and I expect every grain has a value."
So Sam planted saplings in all the places where specially beautiful or beloved trees had been destroyed, and he put a grain of the precious dust in the soil at the root of each. He went up and down the Shire in this labour, but if he paid special attention to Hobbiton and Bywater, no one blamed him. And at the end he found that he still had a little of the dust left, so he went to the Three-Farthing Stone, which is as near the centre of the Shire as no matter, and cast it in the air with his blessing. The little silver nut he planted in the party field where the tree had once been, and he wondered what would come of it. All through the winter he remained as patient as he could, and tried to restrain himself from going round constantly to see if anything was happening. Spring surpassed his wildest hopes. His trees began to sprout and grow as if time was in a hurry and wished to make one year do for 20. In the party field a beautiful young sapling leapt up. It had silver bark and long leaves, and burst into golden flowers in April. It was, indeed, a Mullorn, and it was the wonder of the neighbourhood. In after years, as it grew in grace and beauty, it was known far and wide, and people would come long journeys to see it, the only Mullorn west of the mountains and east of the sea, and one of the finest in the world. Altogether 1420 in the Shire was a marvellous year. Not only was there wonderful sunshine and delicious rain, in due times and perfect measure, but there seemed something more, an air of richness and growth, and a gleam of beauty beyond that of mortal summers that flicker and pass upon this middle earth. All the children born or begotten in that year, and there were many, were fair to see and strong, and most of them had a rich golden hair that had before been rare among hobbits. The fruit was so plentiful that young hobbits very nearly bathed in strawberries and cream, and later they sat on the lawns under the plum trees and ate until they had made piles of stones like small pyramids or the heaped skulls of a conqueror, and then they moved on. And no one was ill, and everyone was pleased, except those who had to mow the grass. In the South Farthing the vines were laden, and the yield of leaf was astonishing, and everywhere there was so much corn that at harvest every barn was stuffed. The North Farthing barley was so fine that the beer of 1420 malt was long remembered and became a byword. Indeed, a generation later one might hear an old gaffer in an inn, after a good pint of well-earned ale, put down his mug with a sigh.
"Ah, that was proper 1420, that was."
Sam stayed at first at the Cottons with Frodo, but when the new row was ready he went with the gaffer. In addition to all his other labours, he was busy directing the cleaning up and restoring of Bag End, but he was often away in the Shire on his forestry work. So he was not at home in early March, and did not know that Frodo had been ill. On the 13th of that month, Farmer Cotton found Frodo lying on his bed. He was clutching a white gem that hung on a chain about his neck, and he seemed half in a dream. "It is gone forever," he said, "and now all is dark and empty." But the fit passed, and when Sam got back on the 25th, Frodo had recovered, and he said nothing about himself. In the meanwhile, Bag End had been set in order, and Merry and Pippin came over from Crick Hollow, bringing back all the old furniture and gear, so that the old hole soon looked very much as it always had done. When all was at last ready, Frodo said, "When are you going to move in and join me, Sam?" Sam looked a bit awkward. "There's no need to come yet, if you don't want to," said Frodo. "But you know the gaffer's close at hand, and he'll be very well looked after by Widow Rumble." "It's not that, Mr. Frodo," said Sam, and he went very red. "Well, what is it?" "It's Rosie. Rose Cotton," said Sam. "It seems she didn't like my going abroad at all, poor lass. But as I hadn't spoken, she couldn't say so, and I didn't speak because I had a job to do first. But now I've spoken, and she says, 'Well, you've wasted a year, so why wait longer?' 'Wasted?' I says. 'I wouldn't call it that. Still, I see what she means. I feel torn in two, as you might say.' 'I see,' said Frodo. 'You want to get married, and yet you want to live with me in Bag End too. But, my dear Sam, how easy? Get married as soon as you can, and then move in with Rosie. There's room enough in Bag End for as big a family as you could wish for.' And so it was settled. Sam Gamgee married Rose Cotton in the spring of 1420, which was also famous for its weddings, and they came and lived at Bag End. And if Sam thought himself lucky, Frodo knew that he was more lucky himself, for there was not a hobbit in the Shire that was looked after with such care. When the labours of repair had all been planned and set going, he took to a quiet life, writing a great deal and going through all his notes. He resigned the office of deputy mayor at the Free Fair that midsummer, and dear old Will Whitfoot had another 7 years of presiding at banquets. Merry and Pippin lived together for some time at Crick Hollow, and there was much coming and going between Buckland and Bag End. The two young travellers cut a great dash in the Shire, with their songs and their tales and their finery and their wonderful parties. Lordly, folk called them, meaning nothing but good, for it warmed all hearts to see them go riding by with their mail shirts so bright and their shields so splendid, laughing and singing songs afar away. And if they were now large and magnificent, they were unchanged otherwise, unless they were indeed more fair-spoken and more jovial and full of merriment than ever before. Frodo and Sam, however, went back to ordinary attire, except that when there was need they both wore long grey cloaks, finely woven and clasped at the throat with beautiful brooches, and Mr. Frodo wore always a white jewel on a chain that he often would finger. All things now went well, with hope always of becoming still better, and Sam was as busy and as full of delight as even a hobbit could wish. Nothing for him marred the whole year, except for some vague anxiety about his master. Frodo dropped quietly out of all the doings of the Shire, and Sam was pained to notice how little honour he had in his own country. Few people knew or wanted to know about his deeds and adventures. Their admiration and respect were given mostly to Mr. Merry Ardoch and Mr. Peregrine, and, if Sam had known it, to himself. Also in the autumn there appeared a shadow of old troubles. One evening Sam came into the study and found his master looking very strange. He was very pale, and his eyes seemed to see things far away. "What's the matter, Mr. Frodo?" said Sam. "I'm wounded," he answered. "Wounded,
it will never really heal. But then he got up, and the turn seemed to pass, and he was quite himself the next day. It was not until afterwards that Sam recalled that the date was October the 6th. 2 years before, on that day, it was dark in the dell under Weathertop. Time went on, and 1421 came in. Frodo was ill again in March, but with a great effort he concealed it, for Sam had other things to think about. The first of Sam and Rosie's children was born on the 25th of March, a date that Sam noted.
"Well, Mr. Frodo," he said, "I'm in a bit of a fix. Rose and me had settled to call him Frodo, with your leave, but it's not him, it's her. There was pretty a maid child as anyone could hope for, taking after Rose more than me, luckily. So we don't know what to do."
"Well, Sam," said Frodo, "what's wrong with the old customs? Choose a flower name like Rose. Half the maid children in the Shire are called by such names, and what could be better?"
"I suppose you're right, Mr. Frodo," said Sam. "I've heard some beautiful names on my travels, but I suppose they're a bit too grand for daily wear and tear, as you might say. The gaffer, he says, 'Make it short, and then you won't have to cut it short before you can use it.'
But if it's to be a flower name, then I don't trouble about the length. It must be a beautiful flower, because, you see, I think she's very beautiful, and is going to be beautifuller still." Frodo thought for a moment. "Well, Sam, what about Eleanor, the Sunstar? You remember the little golden flower in the grass of Lothlorien?"
"You're right again, Mr. Frodo," said Sam, delighted. "That's what I wanted."
Little Eleanor was nearly 6 months old, and 1421 had passed to its autumn when Frodo called Sam into the study. "It'll be Bilbo's birthday on Thursday, Sam," he said, "and he'll pass the old took. He'll be 131.
"So he will," said Sam. "He's a marvel."
"Well, Sam," said Frodo, "I want you to see Rose and find out if she can spare you, so that you and I can go off together. You can't go far, or for a long time now, of course," he said a little wistfully.
"Well, not very well, Mr. Frodo."
"Of course not. But never mind. You can see me on my way. Tell Rose that you won't be away very long, not more than a fortnight, and you'll come back quite safe."
"I wish I could go all the way with you to Rivendell, Mr. Frodo, and see Mr. Bilbo," said Sam. "And yet the only place I really want to be in is here. I am that torn in two."
"Poor Sam. It will feel like that, I'm afraid," said Frodo. "But you'll be healed. You were meant to be solid and whole, and you will be." In the next day or two, Frodo went through his papers and his writings with Sam, and he handed over his keys. There was a big book with plain red leather covers. Its tall pages were now almost filled. At the beginning, there were many leaves covered with Bilbo's thin, wandering hand, but most of it was written in Frodo's firm, flowing script. It was divided into chapters, but chapter 80 was unfinished, and after that were some blank leaves. The title page had many titles on it, crossed out one after another, so: "My Diary," "My Unexpected Journey," "There and Back Again," and "What Happened After," "Adventures of Five Hobbits," "The Tale of the Great Ring, compiled by Bilbo Baggins from his own observations and the accounts of his friends," "What We Did in the War of the Ring." Here Bilbo's hand ended, and Frodo had written, "The Downfall of the Lord of the Rings and the Return of the King, as seen by the little people, being the memoirs of Bilbo and Frodo of the Shire, supplemented by the accounts of their friends and the learning of the wise, together with extracts from books of lore translated by Bilbo in Rivendell."
"Why, you've nearly finished it, Mr. Frodo," Sam exclaimed.
Well, you have kept at it, I must say.
I have quite finished, Sam, said Frodo, the last pages are for you. On September the 21st they set out together, Frodo on the pony that had borne him all the way from Minas Tirith, and was now called Strider, and Sam on his beloved Bill. It was a fair golden morning, and Sam did not ask where they were going. He thought he could guess. They took the stock road over the hills and went towards the woody end, and they let their ponies walk at their leisure. They camped in the green hills, and on September the 22nd they rode gently down into the beginning of the trees as afternoon was wearing away.
"If that isn't the very tree you hid behind when the Black Rider first showed up, Mr. Frodo," said Sam, pointing to the left. "It seems like a dream now."
It was evening, and the stars were glimmering in the eastern sky as they passed the ruined oak, and turned and went on down the hill between the hazel thickets. Sam was silent, deep in his memories. Presently he became aware that Frodo was singing softly to himself, singing the old walking song, but the words were not quite the same.
Still round the corner there may wait a new road or a secret gate, and though I oft have passed them by, a day will come at last when I shall take the hidden paths that run west of the moon, east of the sun.
And, as if in answer, from down below, coming up the road out of the valley, voices sang,
"O Elbereth Gilfodiel, Silivren pena miriel, O menel agla elenoth, Gilfodiel, a Elbereth, we still remember we who dwell in this far land beneath the trees, the starlight on the western seas."
Frodo and Sam halted and sat silent in the soft shadows until they saw a shimmer as the travellers came towards them. There was Gildor and many fair elven folk, and there, to Sam's wonder, rode Elrond and Galadriel. Elrond wore a mantle of grey, and had a star upon his forehead, and a silver harp was in his hand, and upon his finger was a ring of gold, with a great blue stone, Velia, mightiest of the three. But Galadriel sat upon a white palfrey, and was robed all in glimmering white, like clouds about the moon, for she herself seemed to shine with a soft light. On her finger was Nenya, the ring wrought of Mithril, that bore a single white stone flickering like a frosty star. Riding slowly behind on a small grey pony, and seeming to nod in his sleep, was Bilbo himself. Elrond greeted them gravely and graciously, and Galadriel smiled upon them.
"Well, Master Samwise," she said, "I hear and see that you have used my gift well. The Shire shall now be more than ever blessed and beloved." Sam bowed, but found nothing to say. He had forgotten how beautiful the lady was. Then Bilbo woke up and opened his eyes.
"Hello, Frodo," he said. "Well, I passed the old Took today, so that's settled. And now I think I'm quite ready to go on another journey. Are you coming?"
"Yes, I'm coming," said Frodo. "The ring-bearers should go together."
"Where are you going, master?"
cried Sam, though at last he understood what was happening.
"To the Havens, Sam," said Frodo.
"And I can't come?"
"No, Sam, not yet anyway, not further than the Havens. Though you too were a ring-bearer, if only for a little while, your time may come. Don't be too sad, Sam. You can't be always torn in two. You'll have to be one and whole for many years. You've so much to enjoy and to be." and to do.
But,
said Sam, and tears started in his eyes,
I thought you were going to enjoy the Shire, too, for years and years after all you've done.
So I thought, too, once. But I've been too deeply hurt, Sam. I tried to save the Shire, and it has been saved. But not for me. It must often be so, Sam, when things are in danger. Someone has to give them up, lose them, so that others may keep them. But you're my heir. All that I had and might have had I leave to you.
And also you have Rose and Eleanor, and Frodo Lad will come, and Rosie Lass, and Merry, and Goldilocks, and Pippin, and perhaps more that I cannot see. Your hands and your wits will be needed everywhere. You will be the mayor, of course, as long as you want to be, and the most famous gardener in history, and you will read things out of the Red Book, and keep alive the memory of the age that is gone, so that people will remember the great danger, and so love their beloved land all the more. And that will keep you as busy and as happy as anyone can be, as long as your part of the story goes on. Come now, ride with me. Then Elrond and Galadriel rode on, for the Third Age was over, and the days of the rings were past, and an end was come of the story and song of those times. With them went many elves of the high kindred who would no longer stay in Middle-earth, and among them, filled with a sadness that was yet blessed and without bitterness, rode Sam and Frodo and Bilbo, and the elves delighted to honour them. Though they rode through the midst of the Shire all the evening and all the night, none saw them pass, save the wild creatures, or here and there some wanderer in the dark, who saw a swift shimmer under the trees, or a light and shadow flowing through the grass as the moon went westward. And when they had passed from the Shire, going about the south skirts of the White Downs, they came to the Far Downs, and to the Towers, and looked on the distant sea, and so they rode down at last to Mithlond, to the grey havens and the long firth of Lune. As they came to the gates, Círdan the shipwright came forth to greet them. Very tall he was, and his beard was long, and he was grey and old, save that his eyes were keen as stars, and he looked at them and bowed and said,
All is now ready.
Then Círdan led them to the havens, and there was a white ship lying, and upon the quay, beside a great grey horse, stood a figure robed all in white awaiting them. As he turned and came towards them, Frodo saw that Gandalf now wore openly upon his hand the third ring, Narjar the Great, and the stone upon it was red as fire. Then those who were to go were glad, for they knew that Gandalf also would take ship with them. But Sam was now sorrowful at heart, and it seemed to him that if the parting would be bitter, more grievous still would be the long road home, alone. But even as they stood there, and the elves were going aboard, and all was being made ready to depart, up rode Merry and Pippin in great haste, and amid his tears Pippin laughed.
"You tried to give us the slip once before and failed, Frodo," he said. "This time you've nearly succeeded, but you have failed again. It was not Sam, though, that gave you away this time, but Gandalf himself."
"Yes," said Gandalf, "for it will be better to ride back three together than one alone. Well, here at last, dear friends, on the shores of the sea, comes the end of our fellowship in Middle-earth. Go in peace. I will not say, do not weep, for not all tears are an evil."
Then Frodo kissed Merry and Pippin, and last of all Sam, and went aboard, and the sails were drawn up, and the wind blew, and slowly the ship slipped
slipped away down the long grey firth, and the light of the glass of Galadriel that Frodo bore glimmered and was lost. And the ship went out into the high sea and passed on into the west, until at last, on a night of rain, Frodo smelled a sweet fragrance on the air and heard the sound of singing that came over the water. And then it seemed to him that, as in his dream in the house of Bombadil, the grey rain curtain turned all to silver glass and was rolled back, and he beheld white shores and beyond them a far green country under a swift sunrise. But to Sam the evening deepened to darkness as he stood on the haven, and as he looked at the grey sea he saw only a shadow on the waters that was soon lost in the west. There still he stood far into the night, hearing only the sigh and murmur of the waves on the shores of Middle-earth, and the sound of them sank deep into his heart. Beside him stood Merry and Pippin, and they were silent. At last the three companions turned away, and never again looking back, they rode slowly homewards, and they spoke no word to one another until they came back to the shire, but each had great comfort in his friends on the long grey road. At last they rode over the downs and took the east road, and then Merry and Pippin rode on to Buckland, and already they were singing again as they went. But Sam turned to Bywater, and so came back up the hill as day was ending once more. And he went on, and there was yellow light and fire within, and the evening meal was ready, and he was expected. And Rose drew him in, and set him in his chair, and put little Eleanor upon his lap. He drew a deep breath.
"Well, I'm back," he said.
The End. You've been listening to The Return of the King, the third and final book of The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien, narrated by Robert Inglis. In the authorized version of The Lord of the Rings, from which this recording has been made, the author prefaced the story with a long essay concerning hobbits, the Shire and its government, and the original Shire sources and records in which this story was first recorded.
1. Concerning hobbits. This book is largely concerned with hobbits, and from its pages a reader may discover much of their character and a little of their history. Further information will also be found in the selection from the Red Book of Westmarch that has already been published under the title of The Hobbit. That story was derived from the earlier chapters of the Red Book, composed by Bilbo himself, the first hobbit to become famous in the world at large, and called by him There and Back Again, since they told of his journey into the East and his return, an adventure which later involved all the hobbits and the great events of that age that are here related. Many, however, may wish to know more about this remarkable people from the outset, while some may not possess the earlier book. For such readers, a few notes on the more important points are here collected from Hobbit lore, and the first adventure is briefly recalled. Hobbits are an unobtrusive but very ancient people, more numerous formerly than they are today, for they love peace and quiet and good-tilled earth. A well-ordered and well-farmed countryside was their favourite haunt. They do not, and did not, understand or like machines more complicated than a forge bellows, a water-mill, or a handloom, though they were skilful with tools. Even in ancient days they were, as a rule, shy of the big folk, as they call us, and now they avoid us with dismay and are becoming hard to find. They are quick of hearing and sharp-eyed, and though they are inclined to be fat and do not hurry unnecessarily, they are none the less nimble and deft in their movements.
They possessed from the first the art of disappearing swiftly and silently, when large folk, whom they do not wish to meet, come blundering by. And this art they have developed until to men it may seem magical. But hobbits have never, in fact, studied magic of any kind, and their elusiveness is due solely to a professional skill that heredity and practice, and a close friendship with the earth, have rendered inimitable by bigger and clumsier races. For they are a little people, smaller than dwarves, less stout and stocky, that is, even when they are not actually much shorter. Their height is variable, ranging from between 2 and 4 feet of our measure. They seldom now reach 3 feet, but they have dwindled, they say, and in ancient days they were taller. According to the Red Book, Bandobrastuk, Bull Roarer, son of Isengrim II, was 4'5" and able to ride a horse. He was surpassed in all hobbit records only by 2 famous characters of old, but that curious matter is dealt with in this book. As for the hobbits of the Shire, with whom these tales are concerned, in the days of their peace and prosperity they were a merry folk. They dressed in bright colours, being notably fond of yellow and green, but they seldom wore shoes, since their feet had tough, leathery soles and were clad in a thick, curling hair, much like the hair of their heads, which was commonly brown. Thus the only craft little practised among them was shoemaking, for they had long and skilful fingers and could make many other useful and comely things. Their faces were as a rule good-natured rather than beautiful, broad, bright-eyed, red-cheeked, with mouths apt to laughter and to eating and drinking. And laugh they did, and eat, and drink, often and heartily, being fond of simple jests at all times, and of 6 meals a day when they could get them. They were hospitable and delighted in parties and in presents, which they gave away freely and eagerly accepted. It is plain, indeed, that in spite of later estrangement, hobbits are relatives of ours, far nearer to us than elves, or even than dwarves. Of old they spoke the languages of men, after their own fashion, and liked and disliked much the same things as men did. But what exactly our relationship is can no longer be discovered. The beginning of hobbits lies far back in the elder days that are now lost and forgotten. Only the elves still preserve any records of that vanished time, and their traditions are concerned almost entirely with their own history, in which men appear seldom and hobbits are not mentioned at all. Yet it is clear that hobbits had, in fact, lived quietly in Middle-earth for many long years before other folk became even aware of them. And the world being, after all, full of strange creatures beyond count, these little people seemed of very little importance. But in the days of Bilbo and of Frodo his heir, they suddenly became, by no wish of their own, both important and renowned, and troubled the councils of the wise and the great. Those days, the third age of Middle-earth, are now long past, and the shape of all lands has been changed. But the regions in which hobbits then lived were doubtless the same as those in which they still linger, the northwest of the Old World, east of the sea. Of their original home the hobbits in Bilbo's time preserved no knowledge. A love of learning, other than genealogical lore, was far from general among them, but there remained still a few in the older families who studied their own books, and even gathered reports of old times and distant lands from elves, dwarves, and men. Their own records began only after the settlement of the Shire, and their most ancient legends hardly looked further back than their wandering days. It is clear, nonetheless, from these legends, and from the evidence of their peculiar words and customs, that like many other folk, hobbits had in the distant past moved westward. Their earliest tales seem to glimpse a time when they dwelt in the upper vales of Anduin, between the eaves of Greenwood the Great and the Misty Mountains. Why they later undertook the hard and perilous crossing of the mountains into Eriador is no longer certain.
Their own accounts speak of the multiplying of men in the land, and of a shadow that fell on the forest, so that it became darkened, and its new name was Mirkwood. Before the crossing of the mountains, the hobbits had already become divided into three somewhat different breeds: Harfoots, Stours, and Fallowhides. The Harfoots were browner of skin, smaller, and shorter, and they were beardless and bootless. Their hands and feet were neat and nimble, and they preferred highlands and hillsides. The Stours were broader, heavier in build. Their feet and hands were larger, and they preferred flatlands and riversides. The Fallowhides were fairer of skin and also of hair, and they were taller and slimmer than the others. They were lovers of trees and of woodlands. The Harfoots had much to do with dwarves in ancient times, and long lived in the foothills of the mountains. They moved westward early, and roamed over Eriador, as far as Weathertop, while the others were still in Wilderland. They were the most normal and representative variety of hobbit, and far the most numerous. They were the most inclined to settle in one place, and longest preserved their ancestral habit of living in tunnels and homes. The Stours lingered long by the banks of the great river Anduin, and were less shy of men. They came west after the Harfoots, and followed the course of the Loudwater southwards. And there many of them long dwelt between Tharbad and the borders of Dunland, before they moved north again. The Fallowhides, the least numerous, were a northerly branch. They were more friendly with elves than the other hobbits were, and had more skill in language and song than in handicrafts, and of old they preferred hunting to tilling. They crossed the mountains north of Rivendell, and came down the river Horwell. In Eriador they soon mingled with the other kinds that had preceded them, but being somewhat bolder and more adventurous, they were often found as leaders or chieftains among clans of Harfoots or Stours. Even in Bilbo's time the strong Fallowhidish strain could still be noted among the greater families, such as the Tooks and the Masters of Buckland. In the westlands of Eriador, between the Misty Mountains and the Mountains of Lune, the hobbits found both men and elves. Indeed, a remnant still dwelt there of the Dúnadan, the kings of men that came over the sea out of Westerness. But they were dwindling fast, and the lands of their north kingdom were falling far and wide into waste. There was room and to spare for incomers, and ere long the hobbits began to settle in ordered communities. Most of their earlier settlements had long disappeared and had been forgotten in Bilbo's time. But one of the first to become important still endured, though reduced in size. This was at Bree, and in the Chetwood that lay round about, some 40 miles east of the Shire. It was in these early days, doubtless, that the hobbits learned their letters and began to write after the matter of the Dúnadan, who had in their turn long before learned the art from the elves. And in those days also they forgot whatever languages they had used before, and spoke ever after the common speech, the Westron as it was named, that was current through all the lands of the kings from Arnor to Gondor, and about all the coasts of the sea from Belfalas to Lune. Yet they kept a few words of their own, as well as their own names of months and days, and a great store of personal names out of the past. About this time, legend among the hobbits first becomes history with a reckoning of years. For it was in the 1601st year of the Third Age that the Fallowhide brothers, Marco and Blanco, set out from Bree, and having obtained permission from the High King at Fornost, they crossed the brown river Baranduin with a great following of hobbits. They passed over the bridge of stone bows that had been built in the days of the power of the North Kingdom, and they took all the land beyond to dwell in, between the river and the far downs. All that was demanded of them was that they should keep the great bridge in repair, and all other bridges and roads, speed the king's messengers, and acknowledge his lordship. Thus began the Shire reckoning, for the year of the crossing of the Brandywine,
as the hobbits turned the name, became year one of the Shire, and all later dates were reckoned from it. At once, the western hobbits fell in love with their new land, and they remained there, and soon passed once more out of the history of men and of elves. While there was still a king, they were in name his subjects, but they were, in fact, ruled by their own chieftains and meddled not at all with events in the world outside. To the last battle of Fornost, with the witch-lord of Angmar, they sent some bowmen to the aid of the king, or so they maintained, though no tales of men record it. But in that war the North Kingdom ended. And then the hobbits took the land for their own, and they chose from their own chiefs a thane to hold the authority of the king that was gone. There for 1,000 years they were little troubled by wars, and they prospered and multiplied after the Dark Plague, Shire Reckoning 37, until the disaster of the Long Winter and the famine that followed it. Many thousands then perished, but the days of dearth, 1158 to 1160, were at the time of this tale long past, and the hobbits had again become accustomed to plenty. The land was rich and kindly, and though it had long been deserted when they entered it, it had before been well tilled, and there the king had once had many farms, cornlands, vineyards, and woods. 40 leagues it stretched, from the far downs to the Brandywine Bridge, and 50 from the northern moors to the marshes in the south. The hobbits named it the Shire, as the region of the authority of their thane, and a district of well-ordered business. And there, in that pleasant corner of the world, they plied their well-ordered business of living, and they heeded less and less the world outside, where dark things moved, until they came to think that peace and plenty were the rule in Middle-earth, and the right of all sensible folk. They forgot or ignored what little they had ever known of the guardians, and of the labours of those that made possible the long peace of the Shire. They were, in fact, sheltered, but they had ceased to remember it. At no time had hobbits of any kind been warlike, and they had never fought among themselves. In olden days they had, of course, been often obliged to fight to maintain themselves in a hard world, but in Bilbo's time that was very ancient history. The last battle, before this story opens, and indeed the only one that had ever been fought within the borders of the Shire, was beyond living memory. The Battle of Greenfields, Shire Reckoning 1147, in which Bandobras took, routed an invasion of orcs. Even the weathers had grown milder, and the wolves that had once come ravening out of the north in bitter white winters were now only a grandfather's tale. So, though there was still some store of weapons in the Shire, these were used mostly as trophies, hanging above hearths or on walls, or gathered into the museum at Mickledelving. The Matham House, it was called, for anything that hobbits had no immediate use for, but were unwilling to throw away, they called a Matham. Their dwellings were apt to become rather crowded with Mathams, and many of the presents that passed from hand to hand were of that sort. Nonetheless, ease and peace had left this people still curiously tough. They were, if it came to it, difficult to daunt or to kill, and they were, perhaps, so unwearyingly fond of good things, not least because they could, when put to it, do without them, and could survive rough handling by grief, foe, or weather, in a way that astonished those who did not know them well, and looked no further than their bellies and their well-fed faces. Though slow to quarrel, and for sport killing nothing that lived, they were doughty at bay, and at need could still handle arms. They shot well with a bow, for they were keen-eyed and sure at the mark. Not only with bows and arrows. If any hobbit stooped for a stone, it was well to get quickly under cover, as all trespassing beasts knew very well. All hobbits had originally lived in holes in the ground, or so they believed, and in such dwellings they still felt most at home. But in the course of time they had been obliged to adopt other forms of abode. Actually, in the Shire in Bilbo's days it was, as a rule, only the richest and the poorest hobbits that maintained the old custom. The poorest went on living in burrows of the most primitive kind, mere holes indeed, with only one window or none, while the well-to-do still constructed more luxurious versions of the simple diggings of old. But suitable sites for these large and ramifying tunnels, or smiles as they called them, were not everywhere to be found. And in the flats and the low-lying districts the hobbits, as they multiplied, began to build above ground. Indeed, even in the hilly regions and the older villages, such as Hobbiton or Tuckborough, or in the chief township of the Shire, Mickledelving on the White Downs, there were now many houses of wood, brick, or stone. These were specially favoured by millers, smiths, ropers, and cartwrights, and others of that sort, for even when they had holes to live in, hobbits had long been accustomed to build sheds and workshops. The habit of building farmhouses and barns was said to have begun among the inhabitants of the Marish down by the Brandywine. The hobbits of that quarter, the East Farthing, were rather large and heavy-legged, and they wore dwarf boots in muddy weather. But they were well known to be stores in a large part of their blood, as indeed was shown by the down that many grew on their chins. No half-foot or fallow-hide had any trace of a beard. Indeed, the folk of the Marish and of Buckland, east of the river, which they afterwards occupied, came for the most part later into the Shire up from Southaway, and they still had many peculiar names and strange words not found elsewhere in the Shire. It is probable that the craft of building, as many other crafts beside, was derived from the Dúnedain. But the hobbits may have learned it direct from the elves, the teachers of men in their youth. For the elves of the High Kindred had not yet forsaken Middle-earth, and they dwelt still at that time at the Grey Havens away to the west, and in other places within reach of the Shire. Three elf towers of immemorial age were still to be seen on the Tower Hills beyond the western marches. They shone far off in the moonlight. The tallest was furthest away, standing alone upon a green mound. The hobbits of the West Farthing said that one could see the sea from the top of that tower, but no hobbit had ever been known to climb it. Indeed, few hobbits had ever seen or sailed upon the sea, and fewer still had ever returned to report it. Most hobbits regarded even rivers and small boats with deep misgivings, and not many of them could swim. And as the days of the Shire lengthened, they spoke less and less with the elves, and grew afraid of them, and distrustful of those that had dealings with them, and the sea became a word of fear among them, and a token of death, and they turned their faces away from the hills in the west. The craft of building may have come from elves or men, but the hobbits used it in their own fashion. They did not go in for towers. Their houses were usually long, low, and comfortable. The oldest kind were, indeed, no more than built imitations of smiles, thatched with dry grass or straw, or roofed with turves, and having walls somewhat bulged. That stage, however, belonged to the early days of the Shire, and hobbit building had long since been altered, improved by devices, learned from dwarves, or discovered by themselves. A preference for round windows, and even round doors, was the chief remaining peculiarity of hobbit architecture. The houses and the holds of Shire hobbits were often large, and inhabited by large families. Bilbo and Frodo Baggins were as bachelors very exceptional, as they were also in many other ways, such as their friendship with elves. Sometimes, as in the case of the Tooks of Great Smiles, or the Brandybucks of Brandy Hall, many generations of relatives lived in comparative peace together, in one ancestral and many-tunnelled mansion. All hobbits were, in any case, clannish, and reckoned up their relationships with great care. They drew long and elaborate family trees with innumerable branches.
In dealing with hobbits, it is important to remember who is related to whom, and in what degree. It would be impossible in this book to set out a family tree that included even the more important members of the more important families at the time which these tales tell of. The genealogical trees at the end of the Red Book of Westmarch are a small book in themselves, and all but hobbits would find them exceedingly dull. Hobbits delighted in such things, if they were accurate. They liked to have books filled with things that they already knew, set out fair and square with no contradictions.
2. Concerning Pipeweed.
There is another thing about the hobbits of old that must be mentioned, an astonishing habit. They imbibed or inhaled, through pipes of clay or wood, the smoke of the burning leaves of a herb, which they called pipeweed or leaf, a variety, probably, of Nicotiana. A great deal of mystery surrounds the origin of this peculiar custom, or art, as the hobbits preferred to call it. All that could be discovered about it in antiquity was put together by Meriadoc Brandybuck, later master of Buckland, and since he and the tobacco of the South Farthing play a part in the history that follows, his remarks in the introduction to his Herb Lore of the Shire may be quoted. "This," he says, "is the one art that we can certainly claim to be our own invention. When hobbits first began to smoke is not known. All the legends and family histories take it for granted. For ages folk in the Shire smoked various herbs, some fouler, some sweeter. But all accounts agree that Tobold Hornblower of Longbottom in the South Farthing first grew the true pipeweed in his gardens in the days of Isengrim II, about the year 1070 of Shire reckoning. The best homegrown still comes from that district, especially the varieties now known as Longbottom Leaf, Old Toby, and Southern Star. How Old Toby came by the plant is not recorded, for to his dying day he would not tell. He knew much about herbs, but he was no traveller. It is said that in his youth he went often to Bree, though he certainly never went further from the Shire than that. It is thus quite possible that he learned of this plant in Bree, where now, at any rate, it grows well on the south slopes of the hill. The Bree hobbits claim to have been the first actual smokers of the pipeweed. They claim, of course, to have done everything before the people of the Shire, whom they referred to as colonists. But in this case their claim is, I think, likely to be true. And certainly it was from Bree that the art of smoking the genuine weed spread in the recent centuries among dwarves and such other folk, rangers, wizards, or wanderers, as still passed to and fro through the ancient road meeting. The home and centre of the art is thus to be found in the old inn of Bree, the Prancing Pony, that has been kept by the family of Butterbur from time beyond record. All the same, observations that I have made, on my own many journeys south, have convinced me that the weed itself is not native to our part of the world, but came northward from the lower Andwin, whither it was, I suspect, originally brought oversea by the men of Westerness. It grows abundantly in Gondor, and there is richer and larger than in the north, where it is never found wild, and flourishes only in warm, sheltered places like Longbottom. The men of Gondor call it sweet galenas, and esteem it only for the fragrance of its flowers. From that land it must have been carried up the Greenway during the long centuries between the coming of Elendil and our own days. But even the Dúnedain of Gondor allow us this credit. Hobbits first put it into pipes. Not even the wizards first thought of that before we did. The one wizard that I knew took up the art long ago and became as skilful in it as in all other things that he put his mind to.
3. Of the Ordering of the Shire. The Shire was divided into four quarters. The farthings already referred to, north, south, east, and west, and these again each into a number of folklands, which still bore the names of some of the old leading families, although by the time of this history, these names were no longer found only in their proper folklands.